Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome everybody, welcome to Collège de France for this meeting which is quite moving for me. My first word must be thank you. A big word of thanks to all of you, my close colleagues, my friends, for coming sometimes from quite far away to celebrate decades of advances in cognitive science, neuroscience and education. And this event is a triple celebration for me. Some of you know this. It's 20 years at Collège de France, where my chair of experimental cognitive psychology was inaugurated in 2005. It's 40 years of cognitive science research, because I entered the labs of Jean-Pierre Changeux and Jacques Meller in 1985. And it's been 60 years since my own neurons started to whiz and fire. So, the title, thank you. So the title of this meeting, Seeing the Mind, Educating the Brain, is deliberately paradoxical and provocative. We do not see the mind, we visualize only the brain with our wonderful brain imaging tools, but increasingly by viewing it, we can decode thoughts and feelings, we see mental states. And conversely, in our schools and families, we do not really educate the brain, we educate children, we change their mental representations, but we understand better and better how education changes the brain, how reading and math put their mark on our neuronal circuits, and we can use this knowledge to improve our schools. So the goal of the next 3 days is to examine the recent progress in both fields with close colleagues, friends, and past or present members of the lab who share the same fascination for those questions. And the meeting is also a homage to my three mentors, Jacques Meller, who founded the journal Cognition, introduced France to the rigorous methods of cognitive science, and was a giant in the field of infant cognition and language acquisition. Jean-Pierre Changeux, who is here today with us, will speak tomorrow, and whose classic book, Neuronal Man, I read when I was 17. It changed my life by convincing me that science could bridge the gap between brain and mind by building neuronal models of cognitive functions. And together, over 40 years, we developed ideas about consciousness, mathematics, their neuronal underpinnings. So thank you very much, Jean-Pierre. And my third mentor, Mike Posner, will be watching us from Oregon. Thank you, Mike, for your wonderful friendship and for being a precursor in so many fields, including attention and mental chronometry, cognitive neuroimaging, and the bridge between neuroscience and education, which I'm still pursuing to this day. Now, Jacques, Jean-Pierre, and Mike are not the only giants on whose shoulders I've been sitting. And I must confess that in organizing this meeting, I faced a difficult problem. The number of close colleagues who over the years have been working with or around the lab and whose work I admire so much is huge. And for material reasons, not all of them could give talks, and I had to make impossible choices. I would like to apologize to all my colleagues who are not able to present at these meetings, many of whom appear on these slides. Their research is outstanding, and we will need to organize another meeting, maybe in 10 years or 20 years. Today, I had to select colleagues, and I selected those who traveled from far away, who left the lab a long time ago, asking only a few local and primarily young researchers to present their own work. Finally, I would like to end this introduction by a list of what I see as some of the prominent issues in the field. And this will also be an excuse to briefly show some recent work from those colleagues and from the lab. 125 years ago, in 1900, the mathematician David Hilbert presented a list of 10 mathematical problems at the Paris International Congress of Mathematicians. And this list was extended later to 23 problems, stimulated mathematicians throughout the 20th century. Well, very immodestly, and given our shared love of hats, as I was preparing this meeting, I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a list of Hilbert problems for human cognitive neuroscience? So let me propose you a tentative list that will perhaps guide our discussions for the next 3 days. So my first question is, what is our cognitive startup kit? Is it minimal, and does nurture do most of the work, as the connectionist movement was trying to convince us? Or is it extremely rich and basically defining our human nature? There is no longer any question that the human brain starts in life in an extremely organized state. All major bundles of connections are in place, major functional circuits can be activated for spoken language, for vision of faces, places of objects. Can we make a complete list of the core knowledge, to take the words of Liz Spelker, that this biological organization grants us. It's now very likely that we inherit from evolution a complete starter kit for numbers, for space, probabilities, objects, people, and more. And here I'd like to acknowledge the fabulous work of Ghislaine. You know that I'm totally unbiased. In this paper, for instance, with Giulia Gennari, we see that infants automatically encode numbers, regardless of whether it is a number of successive sounds or a number of simultaneous visual dots. Even better, by recording the EEG from an unusually dense array of electrodes, one can build a decoder that, after an auditory sequence has ended, can tell from the baby's brain's activity how many sounds he or she heard. And the same decoder can then generalize to a visual number of dots. This clearly shows that an abstract amodal number sense is part of our initial toolkit, and Andreas Nieder will be speaking about that as well. So William James used to say that the baby is in a state of blooming, buzzing confusion, but actually this is perhaps a better representation of the baby's mind, a genius. In my books, I compare it to a supercomputer because it already possesses a highly structured set of mental representations and learning algorithms. My second question then will be, how do we acquire new skills? Our brain is innately structured, but it is also extremely plastic for at least 20 years. And we invented education precisely to stuff that window of plasticity with a ton of stimulation that adds a lot to our initial abilities. How do we do this? What are the learning rules? In the lab, we study this in the domain of math and reading. And here, I'd like to pull my hat off, virtually at least, to my best friend and close colleague, Laurent Cohen, who is here. Where is Laurent? Somewhere. I know he's here. He's hiding. Here. And with Laurent, we've been studying together the origins of reading for almost three decades now. Thank you, Laurent. In this lovely work with Minya Jan, using high-resolution 70 imaging, we saw that reading acquisition specializes minuscule patches of cortex, you see in one subject here, and they are specialized just for letter strings in the writing system that we master. For instance, they will not fire to numbers, but only to letters, and it is bilingual in French or English. And the theory is that this region lies at the crossroads between vision and language and can extract the statistics of written letters, becoming increasingly responsive to stimuli that approximate the statistics of English and French in this bilingual person. So the brain seems to act as a statistician. Unfortunately, even 70 imaging will not tell us exactly how information is encoded in each patch of cortex. And here, I am happy to acknowledge the remarkable work that led to the arrival at Neurospin of an even bigger MRI machine, the world record Iselt magnet. As you can see, it took 8 years from the arrival of the machine to the first functional images. But I'm happy to say that thanks to Nicolas Boulan and his team, the magnet is now working. And we're starting actually next week our first cognitive study with the hope of seeing language and math circuits in greater detail. And this leads me to my third question. Can artificial neural networks provide a bridge to the neuronal level? We need to understand cognition all the way down to the single neuron level. But brain imaging alone will never resolve single neurons. I argue that we need simulation models to understand the neuronal mechanisms of cognitive computations. And I'm illustrating this idea here with the recent work of Akash Agrawal in the lab. We took a classical model of vision, Cornet, which has been trained to recognize 1,000 categories of images, and then we recycled it to recognize visual words, written words. When doing so, we found that there are neurons that specialize for written words, much like the previous fMRI patches of cortex. And because the model can be entirely dissected, synapse by synapse, we understood the neural code in this model. Each neuron prefers a given letter at a given ordinal position relative to the space left of the right, left or right of the word. For instance, there is a unit here that responds to letter A at the beginning of the word, regardless of case. Once we are guided by this model, we could return to experiments and confirm this idea with humans using MEG, fMRI, intracranial recordings, and now even monkeys in Arun's lab. Monkeys cannot read, of course, but they can mimic the visual stage of reading and learning to read, and we see that the predicted ordinal code is appearing and is expanding when the monkeys learn. My fourth question is how the brain represents concepts. In perception, we are making good progress, I think, but at the semantic level, I would argue that we are still very much in the fog. So this is a very open and pressing area. A lovely finding by Rodrigo Cuyan Quiroga and colleagues is that the human brain contains concept cells that fire preferentially to individual people, such as here Luke Skywalker, or other concepts, sometimes very abstract, like numbers, in the work of Florian and Andreas Nieder. They are conceptual because they respond equally well to pictures and to words for the concepts, and I'm happy to report on our wonderful collaboration with Florian Mormann, who is here, and Katharina and Yair. We found neurons that respond to all sorts of concepts, such as here a neuron that fires to bakery items, and crucially, with a graded response to nearby concepts in semantic space. The analysis shows that this data is best captured by vector models of semantic space. And if this is true, it supports the idea that meaning could be encoded by vectors in the brain. But there are still many mysteries on how this is done. My fifth question is linked. How do our concepts expand with education? We cannot be born with concepts of bakery items or Luke Skywalker. We must acquire them. And yet there is a conundrum. How can we acquire new concepts with a fixed and finite set of neurons? For instance, Maria Malric and I study mathematicians. Mathematicians possess thousands of additional concepts in mathematics, and yet this knowledge still relies on the very same circuitry for elementary number sense that we find in young children. So the only hypothesis that I can think of is that as we learn, new dimensions of high-dimensional vector space are being allocated to accommodate the new concepts. And we are currently testing the idea with fMRI, tracking the expansion of neural circuits in young children as they acquire mathematics in arithmetic or geometry. Our first finding is that the mass responsive areas are already present in these young people, but they become increasingly responsive, they expand slightly, and more interestingly, they respond to an increasing number of statements, and they seem to do so by differentiating them, such as the dimensionality of the brain vectors increases. Thus, a plausible but preliminary idea is that with concept learning, neural activity expands in high-dimensional neural space. But we are barely seeing that at 7 Tesla. We are also studying this in specific cases, such as the acquisition of new number concepts. I have two wonderful granddaughters, and I recently asked one of them, are there any numbers between 1 and 2? And she looked at me and she said, what? Of course not. There are no numbers between 1 and 2, right? It's just 1 and then 2 and 3. Right? Well, we all know that, in fact, they are decimal numbers, they are fractions, they are densely packed, the interval between 1 and 2. So how is it possible to expand our concepts of numbers in this way? We're just starting to ask this with 7 Tesla by scanning adults at 7 Tesla. We get a high-resolution picture of the neural vectors that encode the numbers 0 through 5, but also the fractions, 1/4, 1/3, 1/2, and so on. And their similarity structures indicate a partial integration of fractions and integers. The principal components of brain activity reveal a systematic organization, a number line, where the fractions occupy a different place, but they are still ordered in the same way as the integers. Okay. We can also study how to facilitate this conceptual integration. I'm very excited by the work of Maxime Côté in the lab whose new curriculum called Captain Frac seems to dramatically facilitate the acquisition of fractions in young children. My fifth question is some knowledge only accessible to humans? This question echoes the title of Arun's talk that he will give on Friday, Do Monkeys See the World the Way We Do? With some training, could a monkey have painted this beautiful deer and this rectangle in Lascaux, or are these ideas utterly inaccessible to their brains? In the lab, we capitalize on the idea of a language of thought, as illustrated here in the case of geometry and arithmetic, the idea that humans expand their ideas through the composition of old ones by using symbols and rules. According to this view, some of the concepts that are easy for us, such as the number 5, the successor of 1, or the concept of a square, is just inconceivable by species that would not have a language of thought. And we have some data to support this view. The beautiful work of Matthias Sablemeyer shown that when we see a quadrilateral, we are automatically attracted to the regularities of this figure, such as a square, and we detect regularities much more easily among squares or rectangles than among random shapes. Matthias just used, first of all, we tested this geometrical regularity effect in non-human primates, and it is reliably absent, for instance, here in baboons. And Matthias just used MEG and fMRI to show that indeed humans seem to rely on a distinct brain circuit to recognize such shapes, not the usual fast occipitotemporal route, which is captured by convolutional neural networks, but a late and dorsal parietal pathway here in fMRI and also in MEG. This is just appearing in eLife very soon. So this circuit is very much overlapping with the one that we find for mathematics. And we suggest that the language of mathematics and the concepts that it generates, even as simple as a square, might be unique to humans. We have human unique concepts. And this leads me to my seventh question: what is human singularity? What is special about the human brain? I think that this is truly a fabulous question, and one that can be asked at every level, from the genetic to the molecular, the single neuron, the circuit, and the cognitive level. This slide shows you the hypothesis which is guiding our research in the lab, that many, perhaps all, circuits of the human brain have acquired, through evolution, something new, a capacity for symbolic composition. In many domains, from natural language to mathematics, music, theory of mind, and even tool use, the human brain discretizes concepts and then assigns them symbols to compose recursively. These slides argue in particular that there is a major distinction between parallel networks, one dorsal for mass and one ventral for language, but it's just a hypothetical scheme and we need to test it. I am convinced that there are neural codes that remain to be found and that are strictly unique to the human brain. And about 8 years ago, Peter Rulsemer and I started to discuss this idea. Peter is here. And we came up with a very simple idea. If there are symbols and rules in the brain, they require pointers. The brain must be able to use a simple pointer such as this or that or him pronouns in language to refer to past information and manipulate it in a lightweight manner. And so we came up with this experiment where you start with a single concept cell. In this case, it's a neuron that's responding to Shrek. I'm sorry for this, but it just happens that even cartoon characters have their own neurons in the brain. And so would it respond to a pronoun? Imagine you present a sentence such as Shrek and Courtney Love went into the bar. It starts like a joke, right? But then you say, he sat at the table. If the sentence was she, it could not refer to Shrek. But if it's he, it refers to Shrek, right? And what we found is that indeed, the very same neuron that responds to Shrek as a noun or as a picture can also respond to the pronoun, but only if the pronoun is appropriate to evoke the corresponding concept. The very same pronoun will not if Shrek was not mentioned in the preceding sentence. And this is the same data, averaged across 53 neurons, and you can see that there is this very clear activation to the noun, but also activation to the pronoun, to the pointer, right? So this is something quite extraordinary that I'm not sure we might be seeing in a non-human species, not even clear how you would look for it. Something particular to language processing. And here is a decoder. I think Peter will expand on this data, so I'm going very fast. But notice the scale. It goes all the way to one, which means that from 53 hippocampal cells, you can decode very well out of three possibilities. What is the referent of the pronoun? What the person is thinking of when she sees a pronoun. So there are neuronal pointers in the human brain, and I believe that there are many neural codes, perhaps specific to human symbols, that remain to be discovered. And this leads me to my eighth question. How do neurons represent recursive structures? As noted by Noam Chomsky, recursion is a key property of all our human languages, natural or artificial. Our sentences are made of constituents nested inside each other, but syntax is also present in many other domains of human competence, from theory of mind to mathematics, music, or action plans. We still have no good idea how such structures are encoded in the brain. And I'm happy to acknowledge here 30 years of work with my great colleague Christophe Pallier. I would argue that for natural language, at least, the relevant circuit is circumscribed. And we even saw, I think, the right kind of signals, such as these ramping up signals when successive words are bound together into a constituent structure. So we have hints of how the information is being coded. And Jean-Rémy King, one of the most brilliant ex-members of the lab who is here, will be presenting exciting new evidence on how this circuit works. There's a beautiful movie that I borrowed from Jean-Rémy here showing how AI may help us because the different layers of a large language model can map onto different circuits. So perhaps all we have to do now is to dissect how these networks encode recursion and then check whether the brain is doing something similar. So we are close to the answer, but we don't have it. Okay, my ninth question, unsurprisingly, is still what is consciousness? Many cognitive processes, all of those that I described, can unfold without awareness, but not all of them. And what is the difference between conscious and non-conscious processing? Why do we have conscious experiences at all? I won't dwell on this issue because so many of you will be talking about this issue. But you know that Jean-Pierre, Lionel, and I have been sticking our net out with this idea of a global neuronal workspace. We argue that consciousness is a computational property associated with a certain level of information processing whose architecture could therefore be implemented in machines. And the theory says that conscious access occurs when a piece of information is amplified and broadcasted in a process that we call ignition. And it's exciting that recent data and simulations support this idea of ignition. In about 300 milliseconds, the brain seems to transition from early objective and continuous processing, linear processing of the duration of the stimulus, all the way to a late subjective all or none ignition with a point of view, subjective point of view on the external world. So there are traces of ignition in the brain, but is this a viable theory? Can we make it more precise? I really look forward to hearing your critiques, your data, your ideas on this issue. And finally, my 10th question is how can our scientific research improve the human condition? Scientific research should result in societal advances for all. And I'm thinking in particular about the field of evidence-based education. With Cassandra Potier-Watkins, who leads our XLO initiative, we are trying to translate our knowledge of the science of reading into a full curriculum for reading acquisition, which is now deployed, thanks to Cassandra, in hundreds of schools in France, Colombia, Brazil, Argentina, the Dominican Republic. Nama Friedman will be speaking. She has developed wonderful new tests of dyslexia, among other actions in favor of patients, young patients and older patients. We are also moving into the field of math education. We analyze the determinants of success in math and why young girls might be failing so early on in their education. And the team is just starting to create a full math curriculum. This is crazy enough, actually, for grade 3 and 4, we are creating a full curriculum with Marie Lubineau and Maxime. And we are deploying this in schools from the cognitive inspiration that we get from our experiments. This is called Pioneers of Math. I hope it will work. So I'm grateful to all our sponsors, and in particular to the Foundation of Collège de France and the action Agir pour l'éducation for making this possible. If you are curious, this is the website for Kalulu, the reading method that we developed in a free and open source manner. Anyone can develop new languages into it. Please don't hesitate to spread the word. So this is a summary list of those 10 questions that I see as tractable guidelines for future research. This list may look too ambitious, maybe even pretentious, but I know that many of you in this room are already contributing to dramatic progress in each of these areas, and I look forward to hearing from you. I would like to close by thanking you again for your presence and to extend my thanks to my institution, Collège de France, for hosting me during those 3 days, but also during 20 years. To all the other institutions who have been supporting the research, in particular the Atomic Energy Commission and INSERM, and to ERC, the European Research Council, which is financing a large part of this meeting, and to Laurence, Khadija, and especially Vanna for putting it all together. I think they deserve a warm round of applause from you. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site. Collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.